With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Friday, October 13th. Coming up in today's show, we hear from the California Ag Secretary with a message for the citrus industry. That's in just a few moments, but first. The House Agriculture Committee recently held its sixth and final Farm Bill listening session in upstate New York. Committee Chair Mike Conaway said the listening session in New York, along with the five others, including California, were invaluable to the committee as it looks toward developing a new Farm Bill. Disaster recovery programs are a big part of the Farm Bill. Conaway is looking into the possibility of getting some immediate help for farmers and ranchers in Texas and Florida. At the same time, they're trying to put together the most effective disaster recovery programs they can design into the new Farm Bill.
What are you going to do right now? What are we going to do right now? The waiting on the Farm Bill, which generally takes effect in payments would be in 2019, that's way too far to address what's going on right now. So the question is, how do we get that supplemental that was just dropped last night? I've not had a chance to look through it to see exactly what's going on, but it'll have help on the disaster relief side that FEMA would go. So any of our producers whose homes were destroyed, those kind of things would have access to that. I know there will be additional supplementals, and that's kind of the talk from the Texans and the Floridians and those kind of things. Where can we get some additional relief there?
Disaster relief will be a very important part of discussions in developing the new Farm Bill.
One of the talking points for having a Farm Bill is that we've been able to avoid ad hoc disaster relief payments, and so we're going to be very cautious about getting outside the bounds of the Farm Bill as we look at this response. But just now getting to the cumulative impact of what happened and what those losses are, and once we see that, I think we'll have a better sense of just what we need to do and how quickly we need to do it. But you're really talking about two different things. One, help now through the supplemental relief programs, as well as how do our commodity programs and crop insurance and others react to this disaster. That will inform us as to, are there holes in it, are there things we need to fix going forward.
The devastation to the Texas cotton crop is a good example of the kinds of events that the Farm Bill needs to anticipate and be able to effectively provide help for.
One of the things we're looking at is we had cotton destroyed in Texas that was at its final stages. Some of it had already been harvested. So all of the input costs were in that crop. The producer had spent all the money they were going to spend, and then they lost the crop. They lost a record crop, which you cannot insure. And so is there a way to look at risks across the spectrum of the growing season and ways to look at that? But those are the kind of conversations we'll be having. But that's a fix that would not take effect until at the earliest a year from now.
That's House Ag Committee Chair Mike Conaway. The Citrus Research Board held its annual conference this week. Taylor Hillman was there and has this report.
On Wednesday, California Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross spoke at the Citrus Research Board's annual conference. Ross couldn't help but express her sadness and update AgNet West on the wildfires in Northern California.
Well, just because of the still dangerous situation and the fact the winds are back today, so we're seeing mergers of fires, fire skipping, we're still not in that safe zone of even beginning to do containment. So it's too early for actual assessments of agricultural losses, infrastructural losses. When you think about all of those vineyards as permanent structures and the irrigation infrastructure, let alone the processing losses. And so many of my friends, our friends, and employees of the Ag Commissioners who themselves have lost homes.
Ross said they've heard of some livestock producer challenges in particular, but help from organizations and the president has been swift.
The livestock industry has an acute issue right now of being able to move animals out or move water and food in. And we've gotten great cooperation from CHP when it's safe to do so. And safety is the number one thing. We've had FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has been embedded with our fire team since Sunday night. We were giving warnings since last Friday of high winds that could cause fire damage. And then just how immediate the president responded to our declaration of emergencies, and yesterday confirming concurrence in that, which frees up dollars just to get things like water, cots, beds to people where they are.
So what can CDFA do to help? Ross said bringing any amount of comfort for people that are displaced.
Getting food to the food banks and to the shelters, because there's no electricity. There's very spotty cell phone service. But you want to have people to be able to eat, what comfort we can. Food is one way of being able to share that.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Hear what Ross's message was to the citrus industry at the Citrus Research Board's California Citrus Conference later in this show. And now we go and check in with Brian German.
The Hunger U Mobile Educational Exhibit has just left UC Riverside with its next stop in UCLA to continue spreading awareness on food insecurity and hunger. Cheyenne Edmondson is a public relations crew member for Hunger U. She noted how participating in their hunger quiz affects local food insecurity needs.
For every challenge taken, our sponsors, which are National Corn Growers Association, GrowMark, and Bill and Melinda Gates, they're very generous. And for every challenge taken, they'll donate money equivalent to one meal to the food pantry that we select at each university we go to.
The 10-week tour will ultimately conclude at the National FFA Convention.
We really strive to always make it to the National FFA Convention because just like 4-H, FFA is a lot of youth that are really pursuing agriculture, and they're the voices and the next generation, and we just firmly believe that they'll make some great changes and really be the motivators in agriculture and advocates.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. This week's Western View is coming up after the break. We will be back in just a moment.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
And now another episode of One Soil to Live.
I just can't let you keep treating it like dirt, Claude.
Well, you know I don't mean to, Samantha. It's just
It's just what? You don't know it's alive?
Well,
it is alive. And if you want to get the most out of it, you'll follow these four principles to keep it healthy and functioning.
All right, Samantha. I'm listening.
First, keep it covered and keep living roots in it throughout the year with diverse plants and rotations. And finally, disturb it as little as possible.
And if I do as you say, Samantha?
If you do, Claude, I have a feeling it'll be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
There's an amazing amount of life in healthy soil. More importantly, that life can help make our nation's farms more productive, profitable, and resilient. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
The California Association of Food Banks Farm to Family Program helps growers and packers recoup costs for products that may otherwise go unused. The program takes secondary products or excess fruits and vegetables from the field to your local food bank and beyond. Many growers and packers receive reimbursement for picking and pack-out costs in addition to receiving a California state tax credit. Join the more than 100 growers and packers who already participate in Farm to Family. Visit cafoodbanks.org to learn more. That's cafoodbanks.org. Farm to Family. Good for families, good for farmers.
Fake news has become a real problem. Too many people get their news online and they trust without verifying and they get bad information. Bad information leads to bad decisions. It's amazingly easy to set up an online publication that looks legit. Websites can be created in minutes and the cost of publishing on the internet is so low anyone can afford to do it. Lately, we've been hearing about fake news of the worst kind, untrue stories created by a foreign country that are designed to influence our elections or create general discontent among the citizens. These are nefarious, but most fake news sites are simply con games. Con artists create an article with irresistible headlines, then set up a web page that's filled with ads from online ad networks. Therein lies the profit. It's in the advertising sold by the big guys like Google AdSense, MediaNet, or Adstera. These online ad networks don't care about content so much. They only care about how many people see and click on the ads. Sometimes the fake news articles step over the line and are outright fraud or slander. But proving those criminal acts is time-consuming, expensive, and difficult. It's hard because the laws are set up to protect our freedom of speech. Freedom of the press is the bedrock of democracy. Any attempt to outlaw fake news threatens that basic right. The best solution would be an educated electorate who doesn't fall for these shenanigans. Unfortunately, not everyone has the ability to see through them. The reality is, people who buy those stories will vote and make purchases, and frankly, they need to be protected from their own gullible natures. The fact that the fake news stories are just clickbait, though, that gives us a way to control them. We could make it illegal to profit from spreading slander or fraudulent stories. Anyone advertising on those sites is benefiting from the story, thus making it financially possible to post the fake news. They should be held accountable if that story does real damage. This would protect freedom of speech. The accuser would need to prove harm, but it puts the onus on the advertiser to ensure the articles are not malicious. Let's get this problem under control before it destroys us. I'm Lynn Wilcox, and that's The Western View, brought to you by Centrus Industry Magazine.
Well, in today's livestock news, the Public Lands Council and National Cattlemen's Beef Association has praised Chairman Rob Bishop and the House Natural Resources Committee for marking up H.R. 3990. That's the National Monument Creation and Protection Act. H.R. 3390 would bring long overdue reform to the National Monument designation process by settling clear parameters for the appropriate size of designations, giving voice to local residents and business owners, and requiring environmental studies before sweeping designations can be made. A markup is an initial step in the legislative process that allows a bill to move forward for further consideration. According to Dave Eliason, president of the Public Lands Council, previous presidents consistently ignored original congressional intent for monument designations to be the smallest area of compatible with conservation objectives. He said repeated abuse of executive authority under the Antiquities Act harmed local economies and communities in rural areas across the country. The Antiquities Act, a mere four paragraphs, has been used to lock up over 500 million acres of land and water without local input or economic analysis. Craig Uden, president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, said H.R. 3390 adds critical details to original vague legislation regarding the creation and management of the national monuments. He said by limiting presidential authority and restoring balance to the monument designation process, the bill would ensure local ranchers and communities are not subject to the whims of an unchecked federal government. Ranchers who hold grazing permits on public lands do vital work that benefit public land, including the improvement of water sources, conservation of wildlife habitat, and maintenance of the open space that Americans enjoy. Both the PLC and NCBA say limitless power to make massive designations under the Antiquities Act poses a serious threat to that noble mission and rich heritage. Well, rains in the plains was not soon enough to help improve pasture conditions in that part of the country. With more on that story, here's Stephanie Ho.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says pastures in range this week are at 41% good to excellent and 25% very poor to poor.
The ribbon of the poorest conditions generally stretch from the northern plains, where we've seen rain, but it came too late for pasture recovery, stretching on across into parts of the Corn Belt.
These states include Montana, the Dakotas, Iowa, and Illinois.
They have had some moisture. We have had an improvement in topsoil moisture, but again, not much greening occurring because of the lateness of the season. If we can sustain this moisture through the winter, we'll see improvement come spring.
He says California, Oregon, and Washington continue to have high percentages of very poor to poor pastures.
On the flip side, we continue to see some rather good pasture and rangeland conditions in parts of the east, especially where some of the tropical rains have fallen.
These states include Alabama and Kentucky. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Stephanie, and I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
Peanuts, a crop grown in the South. It's not a nut, it's a legume. Has a multitude of uses, both nutritionally and commercially. But everybody knows its most prominent product, peanut butter. But listen to this. A dozen men in Alabama found a new use for peanut butter. They used it to help them escape from prison. A lot of details I don't know about, but essentially they used the jar of peanut butter to alter or cover the cell numbers, which somehow confused the staff on duty and allowed them to break out of jail. They were all recaptured a short period later, but it left the whole world with a new use for peanut butter. You get it? One other strange peanut butter fact. It was invented in the late 1800s by a Canadian. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Reiner, AgNet West.
For today's interview segment, we rejoin AgNet West Taylor Hillman, who spoke with California Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross about her message to the citrus industry and the fight against long bean disease.
My name is Karen Ross, and I'm Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture.
You just got done here at the Citrus Research Board's annual conference. You started off by relating this to another disease 10 or 15 years ago. I think some people forget that we have, maybe not to this scope, but we have gone through diseases and pests like this.
And there's a lot to learn. But it's so frightening at the time to be in the heat of that battle. And so that's why this is a really good time and a crossroads to do a strategic plan, because we've got to be in this for the long haul and make sure we're putting the resources around the right priorities. It's about keeping the pest, could vector the disease, away from our commercial production, and to rapidly work on long-time cures. One of the things we learned in Pierce's disease was that we were leaving the reservoir of the bacterium there. So that's why the early detection tools are so critically important. If in fact we identify a tree that has the bacterium in it, we need to be able to, with assurances, because that's a big investment, to pull out that tree as quickly as possible. So it's things like that. I forgot to mention that just next week, the Executive Committee of the Citrus Committee and the Pierce's Disease Board are going to meet to share lessons learned, some of the strategies, because there's some of the research that's happened in Pierce's disease has application for this and vice versa, how we work with our nursery partners. So there's a lot for us to learn from each other.
You talked about those investments and how California really has invested in the right way. What are some of those investments that we've done, the smart investments we've done as far as the industry has, in trying to get out in front of this and learning what we can from the Florida situation?
Well, it's easy to overlook the importance of that early investment in public outreach and just making sure that there was awareness in Southern California, where two-thirds of the Californians live and where everybody prizes their citrus, that this is a disease that could be coming here. So that when we had detections, we already had a level of knowledge about it. It wasn't just like, who are you asking to come in and check my backyard citrus tree? That was a huge investment. And that was from lessons learned about public acceptance. Some of the early work we're doing now is really around the early detection tools, and there's a lot of interest in the dog detector teams. So we've helped assist with site visits for that, of doing additional sampling on those kinds of things, of doing leaf collection for researchers to perfect that, to get it to a level of certainty that replications are always there. Because if people are going to think about pulling trees or multiple trees in a commercial orchard setting, for example, you want to have more than an 80% degree of certainty, although it's your management decision to make. From a regulatory point of view, it's even more important to get that replication certainty, because we're compelling people to take actions as opposed to a landowner going, this is the right thing for my property.
You talked about a 300% increase in the boots on the ground efforts going on. That throughput for your agency is just massive when you look at everything that's going on. What does that take as far as the agency wide? I mean, that's a lot of effort.
It is, and there is an early investment that the state of California has made for decades and decades. I will tell you that every time I have to buy a new piece of equipment, it's at a cost that's a lot different than it used to be, but it also detects at more smaller levels, so it's pretty. But what you need, great diagnostics and people who are trained in diagnostics, and I'm not sure we always value that piece of science enough to do that good kind of diagnostic work. And it's a commitment and it's a preciseness to go to the labs and see. Some of it's very tedious, you know, the slicing and the smallest amount and the work and the focus that requires, and then having the equipment and the people who are skilled. But one of the reasons we really wanted to expand our lab capacity on the sampling pieces is so that we can focus on the HLB plant samples and use the other labs for the ACP samples, and then we will rerun those when it's necessary. So this is going to be huge as far as just the hours and less weekend time and less overtime hours on the part of our staff, but they're committed to doing it and they will do it.
Once again, Taylor Hillman talking with California Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
The Citrus Research Board invites the citrus industry to attend this year's California Citrus Conference on Wednesday, October 11th in Visalia. Join the CRB at 7:30 for registration and a free breakfast. Sessions kick off at 9 with a focus on ACP control and HLB early detection technologies. California Ag Secretary Karen Ross will address attendees, followed by a free barbecue lunch. Afternoon sessions include post-harvest technologies, biocontrol, and the very latest in citrus breeding and varieties. Pre-register for this free conference online at citrusresearch.org.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
The California Association of Food Banks Farm to Family Program helps growers and packers recoup costs for products that may otherwise go unused. The program takes secondary products or excess fruits and vegetables from the field to your local food bank and beyond. Many growers and packers receive reimbursement for picking and pack-out costs in addition to receiving a California state tax credit. Join the more than 100 growers and packers who already participate in Farm to Family. Visit cafoodbanks.org to learn more. That's cafoodbanks.org. Farm to Family. Good for families, good for farmers.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our technical skills.
Our math, our engineering skills.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our organizational skills, our problem-solving skills.
You're going to need our determination, our honesty, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise, we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. And now more of the agriculture stories you'll want to know today. A new report suggests the Department of Agriculture should develop a new system for gathering information for crop reports and other surveys. USDA contracted with the National Academy of Sciences 3 years ago to audit how USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service collects data. The report highlighted that NASS could make several changes over time to improve the accuracy of its reports, as well as develop guidelines that make data collection more transparent and reproducible, that according to DTN. Specifically, USDA asked the Academy to look at how NASS does county-level crop estimates, as well as cash rent estimates. The report says a vision for the service in 2025 should focus on changing the Agricultural Statistics Board to models that incorporate multiple data sources. NASS uses multiple data sources through the board. However, the report says the current process is inherently subjective and neither transparent nor reproducible. A USDA spokesperson called the report a real opportunity for improvements. The fourth round of negotiations for the North American Free Trade Agreement are in progress this week. American, Mexican, and Canadian negotiators are entering some of the more difficult subject matters they have to deal with. International Trade and Customs Attorney Dan Yutzo said the tone of the Trump administration negotiators is getting more aggressive.
What we saw in round three in Ottawa was really the start of the U.S. putting forward very aggressive positions. The first one was really on government procurement, also known as Buy American, which basically said, we're going to cut back how much Canadian and Mexicans can participate in our government procurement processes here in the U.S. But by the way, we want you in Canada and Mexico to allow more U.S. participation on your side. So I think both Canada and Mexico said, you know, we're not so sure about that, and it certainly ruffled some feathers, and we saw that during the final statements at the end of round three. There was certainly tension between the three head negotiators led on the U.S. side by USTR Robert Lighthizer.
He says the U.S. positions will continue to get more aggressive in round four on things like automotive rules of origin that are the most stringent than in any other free trade agreement in the world. Yutzo expects supply management in Canada to be brought up in this round. Canada's supply management policies have made it very difficult for U.S. dairy, poultry, and eggs to get into the Canadian marketplace. Canada has said it's a red line that they are not willing to budge on. Yutzo says it's a possibility that the Trump administration is counting on that.
I think it's highly likely at the end of round four, when you see things like automotive rule of origin, supply management, the U.S. is talking about a sunset provision, meaning that the NAFTA would terminate after 5 years automatically unless Congress, reauthorized it. Those are things that will cause Mexico and Canada to, at the very least, call a timeout to take these issues back and consider their next move. So there is a very real possibility that the U.S. knows that Canada and Mexico can't negotiate on those issues, and we're left with one conclusion. The U.S. right now may be trying to get Canada and Mexico to walk away from the table.
Yutzo's opinion is if Mexico and Canada don't walk away from NAFTA, the Trump administration will by the end of the year. He says the president campaigned on getting rid of NAFTA or making it friendlier to the U.S. Trump has spoken out publicly against NAFTA since the 1990s.
I think he wants to really do something big, either by the end of the year, because we know those type of year-end reviews matter to him, but it's also going into the political season and the midterm elections. You know, the primaries for the 2018 midterm elections are right around the corner. Those start in, the winter and spring of next year, so I think the president wants to do something big to make sure that 30%, 35% of voters that he secured last year are handily in his pocket and in those likely Republican members of Congress that'll be anti-NAFTA.
A lot of pressure to tear up NAFTA is coming from the manufacturing sector. He says Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue literally saved NAFTA back in April during discussions with the president. Yutzo says it's important for the ag industry to realize that withdrawal is a very real possibility.
If anybody of your listeners don't think that this is a reality, that the president is looking at withdrawal, I want to make it very clear. It's a very real possibility that we will either withdraw or we will reach a deal that I don't think we'll have any chance of getting through Congress in 2018. So now is the time to really start preparing and, more importantly, make your voices heard.
Yutzo says it may be time for Congress to get involved with the negotiations, at least in some terms of oversight. As a 20-year advocate for trade issues, he says it's more important than ever for agriculture to keep pressure on their elected officials regarding the importance of NAFTA. A recent study looks at the potential economic impacts of sanitary and phytosanitary trade barriers on agricultural trade, Rodbain reports.
Concerns about nations using sanitary and phytosanitary barriers as an ag trade impediment have grown over the 20-plus years of existence of the World Trade Organization. As Jason Grant of Virginia Tech University told an audience at this year's USDA Ag Outlook Forum, countries are allowed to set up sanitary and phytosanitary, SPS, measures to protect against disease and pest threats to plants and animals. In fact, from WTO formation in 1995 to the end of 2015,
the WTO has received almost 20,000 SPS measures applied by its members.
Due in part to more safeguards for food and more developing countries filing such notices. However, of those over 19,000 SPS-related notifications, WTO members raised concerns on over 400 of them. And of that number,
only 43 of them actually escalated to a formal dispute settlement.
As Grant notes, several of these concerns are or have been resolved before even reaching the dispute settlement phase within the WTO.
When countries raise a specific SPS trade concern, they're typically resolved in about 4 years. There are obviously some issues that drag out for over 10 years.
Measuring the economic impacts of SPS ag trade barriers may be difficult compared to the quantitative measures of tariffs, yet Grant says it can be done.
What we did is we have this database of specific trade concerns. We matched them with agricultural trade because we observed the product that the countries complain or maintain about. And we matched that with the bilateral trade over the same period and then just computed the change in trade when a specific trade concern was active versus when it was not. So it's a very simple, hopefully straightforward calculation. It's a percentage change.
And what was discovered about these active SPS trade concerns in the WTO was this.
Animal health was responsible for the largest significant drop in trade at about 54%. If you think about the value of U.S. ag exports sitting around $4 to $5 billion just for beef, if you think about that drop, that 50% is translating into $2 to $2.5 billion when these specific trade concerns are operating. So we found that to be rather significant.
Additional findings for percentage of reduction in trade connected to a sanitary and phytosanitary concern include
food safety and plant health issues, about a third. They're lowering trade, 39 and 34% respectively.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.